A decade ago, two bombs went off at the Boston Marathon, a tragic day that still reverberates.
It's definitely changed how we participate in these events.
A moment that changed how security at big sporting events gets done. Also ahead, two entrepreneurs, one new massive wilderness park in Chile.
It's very complicated to build a national park.
The story of how and why an American couple bought up huge swaths of private land in Patagonia. I'm Carol Hills, plus Kalani Bubu. She was a lawyer and TV presenter, then the South African gave it all up to become a singer-songwriter to focus on her country's traditional music.
Let's tune into Kongo Tane, which is a traditional folk song. And so that's one that I leaned into, reinterpreting it for today.
That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. In Boston today, a 21-year-old member of the Massachusetts Air National Guard was charged with violating two laws that protect U.S. government secrets. Jack Teixeira faces two counts of retaining and transmitting national defense secrets. He could face up to 15 years in prison. The trove of documents reveal details about the U.S. stance on Russia, China, Israel, and South Korea, to name just a few places. We called up former senior CIA operations officer Mark Polymeropoulos to discuss all of this. Mark, what were your first thoughts when you learned the identity of the person who's been charged with leaking these documents?
Well, that's a great question because, of course, there's some irony. Of course, I'm talking to you in Boston today, but it was that this individual was a member of an Air National Guard unit in Cape Cod. And so I think kind of collectively, the national security establishment, a lot of the media said, what in the world is happening? You know, why is Cape Cod turning into the center of the intelligence universe? But actually, it is a very legitimate intelligence unit. So first and foremost, the location of it is actually not that much a surprise. And my next reaction is this has some hallmarks of other espionage cases where, you know, someone with a technical background, someone involved in IT who does have quite a bit of access, unfortunately goes bad.
I want to ask again, though, about how a 21-year-old low-level member of the Air National Guard could get access to these documents. I mean, are you saying that, oh, actually, this is a legitimate intelligence locale, so that part of it is not unusual, or is it? Because that's what a lot of people are kind of gasping over.
Right. So that's the thing. So let's not worry about his age. You know, you have in the U.S. military 19-year-old, you know, enlisted members of the U.S. Navy who work on reactors on a nuclear sub. So people at very young ages in the U.S. military gain tremendous responsibility and do get clearances. But this is, at the end of the day, in the classified world, in the world of counterintelligence and security, you know, an IT person does have kind of the keys to the kingdom. This is a classic security issue. It's an individual that we have to figure out how he was hired, you know, what kind of background screening, polygraphs, you know, interviews were done. And then, of course, in his job, and it looks like this is when he went bad, but in his job, what kind of monitoring is done?
So how embarrassing is this for the U.S. in terms of its allies?
So this is the question that I find most interesting, and I think a lot of the initial reactions and the press accounts got this wrong. You know, ultimately, you know, countries, first of all, spy on each other. I don't think there's much outrage that you see, which was reported. You know, we build very strong bilateral relationships between states to weather storms like this. And so, you know, in my experience, you know, we have had espionage scandals, including with our allies. So, look, there might be some difficult conversations with U.S. ambassadors and defense attachés and intelligence personnel with their counterparts, but we're gonna make it through. Remember, there is a land war going on in Europe, the biggest kind of fight since World War II. We're not going to stop any kind of intelligence sharing. I don't think, you know, anyone certainly will restrict that from the U.S. and we'll make it through this. You know, in the intelligence business, you're going to have good days, and you're going to have bad days, and you're going to have days like this, which are difficult. But we'll make it through.
But I was thinking less about what was revealed about other countries and what the U.S. knows about other countries than the fact that this leak happened at all and how secure is the U.S. with important information about its allies.
Right. And I think that, you know, other countries' intelligence services understand that this happens. You know, several months ago, there was a German BND, a German intelligence officer who was arrested by German authorities for spying for Russia. And you didn't see much reaction from the United States in the press on this. And why is that? Because, you know, you got to be careful. You can't throw stones in glass houses. We know this is going to happen to us sometimes as well. So I think there's just a recognition that these things do happen.
Well, on that point, I mean, have there been other recent comparable leaks of military intelligence in other countries that affected the U.S.? And what was the response then?
Right. So going back to, for example, the German case. So this German intelligence officer had provided, allegedly, signals intelligence reports to the Russians on the war in Ukraine. So same type of thing. And so, you know, what a country will do on this is, you know, certainly there will be discussions between allies. And I think that the United States will have to, in some sense, share a damage assessment that was done. That's what we would ask from another country as well. So that would be the right thing to do, again, to repair some of the relationships, which I really think will continue. It just might take a little work. And everybody in the intelligence world kind of thinks the same way. It's not like, you know, we smile when another country has a scandal like this. It's, you know, the reaction in the intelligence business is kind of you cringe a little bit and you say, all right, they're going to have to work through this because we know it happens to us as well.
Mark Polymeropoulos is a former senior operations officer for the CIA. Thanks very much, Mark.
Thank you so much.
Today, the Biden administration asked the Supreme Court to weigh in on a legal battle over mifepristone. That's a medication that can be used to terminate a pregnancy. South of the border in Mexico, activists have helped countless numbers of women safely terminate pregnancies with medication over the years, often sent through the mail. As abortion access in the U.S. gets more restricted, more people here are now reaching out to those activists in Mexico. The World's TBS Isaiah reports.
Veronica Cruz is used to getting notifications on her phone pretty much constantly.
Por nuestro Facebook, por nuestro Instagram.
She says they come through just about every social media platform, and they usually are from pregnant people interested in getting an abortion. Cruz is an activist in Guanajuato, a city in central Mexico. More than 20 years ago, she founded an organization called Las Libres, or The Free. It provides abortion medication and support to people across Mexico.
Nosotras acompañamos su decisión y ponemos todos los recursos disponibles.
We are there as they make their decision and then provide resources and information for free so women don't need to visit a clinic, she says. The service is called in Spanish acompañamiento or accompaniment. It was developed by Mexican activists like Veronica Cruz during the decades when abortion was banned in the country.
Yo creo que hoy no hay una sola ciudad mexicana que no tenga una red de acompañamiento.
Now, there isn't a single Mexican city that doesn't have an accompaniment group, she tells me. Unlike in the U.S., abortion medication can be obtained in Mexico without a prescription. And this has brought rising interest from the U.S., especially after the Supreme Court decision last summer.
En promedio nos llegaban 10 casos diarios de Texas y de otros estados para acompañar, subió a 100 casos.
At the beginning of 2022, Cruz says her group was hearing about 10 people in the U.S. every day.
Tuvimos días con 300 casos.
After Roe was overturned, Cruz says that number went up to 300 per day, all from the U.S. Most of the call come from Texas, but Cruz says they've been helping people in other states too.
Un dato es que la mayoría de las personas que nos buscan solo hablan inglés.
The majority of these Americans don't speak Spanish, she says. But that has not been an issue. Cruz says her organization gets a lot of help from bilingual volunteers in the U.S., along with financial support too.
La población de Estados Unidos empezó a donar dinero.
She says donations from across the border, as little as $10 each, started coming in last summer. Medication abortion has become more common over the years, and that's concerning to abortion opponents. Amy O'Donnell is with a group called the Texas Alliance for Life. She says there needs to be more effort to prosecute people supplying abortion pills to Texan residents.
Our organization has talked to several statewide leaders, office staff, members to discuss ways that we can go about holding people accountable for breaking the law by bringing these chemical abortion drugs into Texas and providing them to women illegally.
She says her group is concerned about abortion medications being supplied by what she calls illegal traffickers.
Illegal trafficking of abortion-inducing drugs is really a federal issue. The Biden-Harris administration is completely pro-abortion, but we do hope that a future pro-life administration will be willing to take action, have those who are breaking the law by trafficking these abortion-inducing drugs illegally extradited to stand trial.
There is an effort in Texas to put new laws on the books aimed at anyone providing abortion services to people in the state. Texas passed a 6-week ban on abortion in 2021. For The World, I'm Tibisa Isaiah.
Let's turn now to South Africa. That's where singer-songwriter Pilani Bubu is from. She spent some time here in the U.S., but it was only when she returned to her homeland that she really dove into the richness of her country's music. The World's April Peavy has this profile.
Pilani Bubu admits she comes from a family of privilege, jumping off the shoulders of giants, she says. A family that encouraged education and creativity.
I studied law and I studied marketing, and then I went into the creative space and realized actually my best medium to communicate and to make any change is to use my best gifts, which was music.
Pilani Bubu was born in 1984 during the last decade of apartheid, in the area now known as Eastern Cape, home to the Xhosa people. As a child of the MTV generation, she straddled the two worlds of globalization and tradition, the traditions of her homeland. But to really understand her heritage, she first had to leave South Africa. In 2012, she left her job in the corporate world and
packed my bags to go to the New Orleans Jazz Fest with, like, my CDs, my demo CD, Journey of a Heart. And I was supposed to stay 5 days during the Jazz Fest, and I stayed 3 months.
Bubu found her music community in the Big Easy, but the people she met there wanted to learn more about her.
And I started including repertoire of music from South Africa, because when you travel in the world, people will look at you as an African girl, an African child, and try to understand a story about your people and your life. And it helped me dig a little bit deeper, and I realized, wow, there was like a wealth of stuff sitting with me that I could share. Let's tune into Qongqo Twane, which is a traditional folk song. And so that's one that I leaned into, reinterpreting it for today. I mean, a lot of the work that I do really is posed to the next generation who, like me, took a lot of our culture for granted. So looking back into traditional folk songs.
This is just one example of the indigenous folk music Bubu records. It's off her album Folklore Chapter 1. Songs of spirit animals, respect for ancestors, and the role of women, too. Topics important to Pilani Bubu.
This is me creating some kind of open conversation to say, I'm looking a little deeper into this. May it inspire you and you do the same, because the pull of music or the work, the culture, the heritage is so big that I can only do such a small part. But if I don't give it meaning and interpret it for the modern day, then it's just going to remain where it is in the past.
The past is always present, and so is the future. Her new album, Folklore Chapter 2, is set to come out later this year. It will be a continuation of her themes of community, but with a more spiritual bent. In the meantime, there's her new album, Lockdown Love Story, and a single with Afronautic that gives her music a contemporary soul sound. Undo your mind. Feeling is believing, but you will find. For The World, I'm April Peavy. Be is what you believe in for your mind. Go with what you're feeling.
New music from South African musician Pilani Bubu. The track is called Feel It. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. A new documentary opens today about two entrepreneurs and environmentalists. It's called Wildlife. As the film begins, one of them has just died thousands of miles from the United States.
Douglas Tompkins died Tuesday in an accident in Chile. He was a passionate conservationist.
Se enamoró de la Patagonia en su juventud, en los años.
That newscaster is saying Tompkins fell in love with Patagonia in his youth in the 1960s and returned to buy the land in the 1990s. Filmmaker Chai Vassarelli is with us. Chai, you create so many questions in the first few minutes of the documentary. I mean, what's going on in Patagonia? Who's Doug Tompkins? Why are we looking at his coffin? And so I want to start with the first question. Who was Doug Tompkins?
Doug Tompkins is one of the original dirtbag climbers. He also ended up founding the North Face, the company, and then Esprit. But at the height of Esprit, when it was like, you know, this huge international company and brand, he had this awakening where he realized that he could do more for the planet. And he could do more, really, like find a more fulfilling, intentional life. And so he left everything behind and moved to Patagonia and set about this 25-year journey to try to preserve the land. And unfortunately, like towards the end, in 2015, he died suddenly in an accident. And that's where we open the film, at his funeral. And the film really starts to explore the journey that's taken by his wife, Christine Tompkins.
You use the term dirtbag climbers, and you're referring to this kind of core group of people who really kind of invented the pastime that so many Americans enjoy now in terms of climbing and hiking and kind of developing the gear that people use.
Yes. I think that Jimmy, who's my filmmaking partner and husband, would also count as a dirtbag climber. And so also featured in the film is Yvonne Chouinard, who founded the Patagonia Company. And I think together, Doug and Yvonne are kind of these iconic figures in the outdoor world and outdoor industry.
Christine has her own kind of rebel origins. Give us a thumbnail sketch of her and what she came out of.
Chris's personal story is extraordinary. Basically, Chris was growing up in Northern California, and she had a big brother, and she was, you know, not quite committed to school. I mean, at one point, she was even kicked out for not wanting to wear shoes at school. I mean, this was totally the 60s. And she would go to the beach with her big brother, and that's where she met Yvonne Chouinard. And her mom basically was like, I'm not going to bankroll you. If you're not going to go to school, you've got to get a job. So Yvonne gave her a job. She made $3 an hour as an assistant packer, okay, for Chouinard equipment, meaning she like would be the person who like tore the newspaper and then handed it to somebody else to wrap, you know.
And this was the precursor to Patagonia. And this was what, in the early 1980s?
It was earlier than that. It was like the late 70s. Huh. Chris eventually became the first CEO of Patagonia and worked there for over 20 years and built the company to a $200 million company by the 80s.
So what was it about Doug Tompkins' story and his wife, Christine, that made you and your partner, Jimmy Chin, decide to make this film?
It really was Christine, this idea of like reinventing yourself, not just Doug deciding that he could do more and, you know, walking the walk and not talking the talk, but just Chris like finding the love of her life in her late 40s. And then ultimately when Doug dies, you know, finding the strength to pick herself up and fulfill their vision and find her own voice. Like this idea that like in your 70s, you can find your voice, you can really make a difference.
And what Doug and Christine set out to do was actually to create national parks in Chile. But the irony, of course, is that in order to do that, they had to buy up land. So there was this weird combination of having the money to buy land, being private owners and wanting to turn them into national parks. To talk about that paradox.
Well, it was about $100 million. And it's not Bezos money. It's not Elon money. But what they did that was so special, like it was important to them for them to be national parks because a national park is protected by the Constitution. But what they did was they, for every 1 acre that they bought, they leveraged that acre and asked the governments to donate 9 acres. So it was a way of creating governmental buy-in. And so using that kind of method, they were able to create the largest private land donation in history. It's like about 15 million acres.
And of course, we're talking about just stunning scenery, stunning landscapes in Patagonia, which straddles Chile and Argentina. And in the film, you tell about the relationship between Doug and Christine and how it was bound up in the Patagonian wilderness. In this next scene, we hear how the couple began creating these conservation parks.
So this is where we got started. This is where we were living. And all of this section became Pumalin, from the border with Argentina all the way out to the Pacific Ocean. This is the first one. We bought 763,000 acres, and it increased from there. None of this is ever done in a vacuum. We go out immediately and talk to everybody, mayors, everybody involved.
That scene really illustrates how the business skills of Doug and Christine came together with their idealism. How hard was that to translate into film?
This film was hard. It was a really, really difficult kind of assembly of it. The amount of time that spans in the film is enormous, right? Like, we first meet them at the beginnings of their careers when they're in their early 20s. And it's very complicated to build a national park. And we tried really our best to spell it out, because I think that the work of it is very important. Like, people need to understand the leverage that was involved, understand the community building that was involved, you know, and understand really why it took 25 years for them to, you know, create the bridges necessary to realize this dream.
Yeah, I think what I found interesting is that Doug and Christine, while it was their idea, they both led and were led. There's a certain part in the documentary where Christine kind of says, yeah, we thought we were kind of creating a national park, but we actually have to create a whole ecosystem.
I mean, Chris says this really lovely thing about how at one point while they're building the parks, they realize that wilderness without wildlife is just scenery, and that all, like, the main participants of the wilderness were missing.
You can't call any of these places restored or healthy until everybody's back.
Chris helped with the reintroductions of over a dozen species at this point, ultimately including the jaguar, which nobody's ever done before.
It was Doug's idea to do whatever we could to bring jaguars back. The jaguar is emblematic. It's at the top of the food chain there. So we have 9 to release. And that's assuming that both the cubs, who are now both females,
yes,
have 2 cubs, maybe 1.
You know, it's wonderful work, and it also never disappoints in that, you know, you're watching those, like, night cameras of the jaguar reserve. You're just watching the jaguar walk by, like, it's the most delightful thing in the world, because it really, like, the amount of work it took to get there is enormous.
And now these parks are on the map. This great Patagonian wilderness has been made accessible to all people. I mean, how has making this film affected your own feelings about the natural world and our efforts to protect it?
Well, this film was very much about our children, and I wanted to create something that told a hopeful story and really was a call to action, and, you know, kind of questioned and demanded that people ask these questions of, like, what is the intentionality of my life? What can I do? And you can't ignore it and can't say it's too big anymore. Because look, like, these two people, like, created the largest, you know, private land donation in the world. And, like, I don't know, I appreciate it. I'm humbled by it. And it was a great pleasure being able to spend so much time in Patagonia.
The documentary is Wildlife, that's 2 words, Wild and Life, by filmmakers Chai Vassarelli and Jimmy Chin. It opens today in select theaters and will be streaming in May. Chai, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, and thank you for taking the time to watch the film.
You're listening to The World. The European Space Agency is setting off for the moons of Jupiter. They're going for a closer look to see if there's water and nutrients lurking below the moon's icy shells.
That's why scientists are excited, because that could be a recipe for life to evolve.
Plus, the female rock climbers of Sonora, Mexico. Ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Monday is a big deal here in Boston. It's a state holiday, Patriots Day. It's also the 127th running of the Boston Marathon. For professional and amateur distance runners across the globe, completing Boston is high on the bucket list. 26.2 miles, starting in the town of Hopkinton, then heading due east through a few suburbs and on to the finish in downtown Boston. And it was there a decade ago when things turned tragic. 2 bombs exploded near the finish line. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on the lasting impact of the Boston Marathon bombings. And a warning, this story contains scenes that may be disturbing for some listeners.
On April 15th, 2013, Diane Nakuri showed up ready to run.
Going into Boston, I definitely felt good and pretty confident.
Nakuri is from Burundi in East Africa. This was her first time running the Boston Marathon, and she ended up getting an impressive 8th place.
I just remember being really excited and packed.
Professional runners all stay at a hotel just one block from the finish line. While the race continued, Nikuri hobbled back to her room and took a shower before going downstairs to eat with the other elite runners.
I was sitting with a bunch of friends, the runners and managers and stuff.
Then at 2:49 p.m.,
we just heard a loud noise. And then we didn't know what was happening.
Nikuri would soon learn that the loud noise was a homemade pressure cooker bomb going off near the same finish line she had crossed just hours before. Thirteen seconds later, another explosion from a similar bomb hidden inside a black backpack. More than 5,000 runners were still on the course, and the finish line's celebratory energy turned to terror.
Today, there were simultaneous explosions.
Just heard a big bang first. I said, Jesus Christ, what the hell was that? And then 5 seconds later...
The second explosion was heard as well. People were very panicked.
Three people died. Locals Martin Richard and Crystal Campbell and Liu Lingzi, an international student from China. More than 260 people were injured. News quickly spread around the world.
South Koreans are paying their respects to the victims of the Boston Marathon bombings.
Here in Hong Kong and across China, the Boston Marathon blasts have been widely reported.
Now, the Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh has come out and condemned the Boston bombings.
And German Foreign Minister Guido Westerwelle said he hopes the investigation will lead to those behind it.
Less than 24 hours later, President Obama labeled the blasts a terrorist attack. After combing through mountains of video evidence, law enforcement began searching for the two suspects, 19-year-old Johar Tsarnaev and his 26-year-old brother, Tamerlan. 100 hours after the bombings, authorities found, shot, and killed the elder of the two. Younger brother Johar was apprehended the next day. Soon, information about the Tsarnaev family came to light. For nearly a decade before the bombings, they lived and worked in Cambridge, Massachusetts, just across the river from Boston. Before that, the family moved from Kalmykia to Kyrgyzstan to war-torn Chechnya, as journalist Masha Gessen told The World in 2015.
Then they started talking about coming to America. In order to come to America, they went first to Dagestan. They land in Dagestan just as the war in Chechnya spreads to Dagestan. And then they finally come to the United States right after 9/11. As Muslim immigrants, and discover that they are a suspect and distrusted group here, too.
Johar's lawyers would later argue that Tamerlan masterminded the attack. Gessen says no single event explains Tamerlan's transition into a terrorist.
This is a kid who's been dragged around and promised a better life his entire life. Every couple of years, he's uprooted and taken somewhere else.
In a Boston courtroom in 2015, younger brother Johar was convicted of the bombing and sentenced to death. Reporter Susan Zalkind told The World that day that Johar appeared enigmatic at the sentencing.
What was going through his mind, why he actually set off those bombs, remains one of the biggest questions. He didn't cry or show any emotion throughout the horrific testimony these past few months. And he didn't cry or show any emotion when his own death was handed down today.
Johar Tsarnaev is now 29 years old and remains on death row. But his lawyers have spent the last 8 years trying to keep him alive. In January, they urged a federal appeals court to throw out the death sentence. Lawyers said two jurors lied about their knowledge of the case. Northeastern criminal law professor Daniel Medved thinks it's a strong argument.
You want to be really vigilant as a judge to make sure that even if those jurors have heard of the case, you feel pretty comfortable that they can put aside what they've learned and have an open mind and be objective. But in the Boston Marathon bombing case, I am hard-pressed to think of a case that was more high-profile.
Medved emphasizes that the current litigation is not a question of Tsarnaev's freedom or incarceration.
It's just a question of where and when he will die. Will he die of natural causes in the Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado, or will he die in an execution chamber?
What's for sure is that the Boston Marathon bombings caused what experts call a seismic shift in security at major sporting events.
It's definitely changed how we participate in these events.
Gary Gardner is an FBI veteran and advisory board member for the National Center for Spectator Sports Safety and Security. He says marathons are one of the most difficult sporting events to secure.
Because it's not totally contained, if you will, like a stadium or an arena.
Gardner says the emergency response in Boston was rightfully praised, but lessons were also learned and applied throughout the world. Bomb-sniffing police dogs became commonplace at races and stadiums alike. Many events changed their bag policy, only allowing small or clear bags into the area. And Russian President Vladimir Putin pointed to the bombings as a reason for increased security at the 2014 Sochi Olympics. Another change has been made to how cities gather security footage. In 2013, Gardner says Boston authorities had to go door to door to get videos from private businesses to identify the suspects.
That was a lesson learned because that was not cataloged beforehand. Okay, whereas now a lot of cities work very closely with their private sector businesses to catalog who has video cameras, what is the view of those cameras, to the extent that some of those actually are fed into an operations center 24/7.
Diane Nakuri, the professional runner from Burundi, now represents the U.S. and lives in Arizona. She returned to Boston in 2017 to race the marathon again.
It is still scary. The fact that you're going to go through that same finish line, but it's not like I'm thinking about it during the run. Like, I was in so much pain finishing, I don't think I was thinking about it.
The bombings were top of mind at the 2014 Boston Marathon, just 1 year after the attack.
Meb is in the city, and he's all by himself.
Meb Keflezighi, an Eritrean refugee representing the U.S., took the lead at a little over halfway into the men's race. In his final strides before the finish line, he made a cross on his chest and won the race with the names of the bombing victims written on his bib.
Meb Keflezighi wins the Boston Marathon!
Unbelievable.
Keflezighi was the first American to win the marathon in over three decades. And the city's slogan, Boston Strong, was never more clear. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
I mean, what can you say?
What can you say? It is the grit. That's Howie, his brother.
Merhawi Keflezighi.
Earlier today in South America's French Guiana, the European Space Agency's JUICE mission launched into space. The agency's latest venture is not centered around an extraterrestrial fruit drink. JUICE stands for Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer. The moons of Jupiter are thought to have more than just ice. Maybe, just maybe, they contain forms of life. David Whitehouse is an astronomer and former BBC science editor. He joins us from here on Earth, Hampshire, England, to be precise. David, tell us about the destination of this mission.
It's going to a remarkable part of the solar system. Jupiter, the largest planet, has four major moons, three of which are icy moons, the icy moons of JUICE's name. And they're remarkable worlds. They're very different to look at, but they're fundamentally the same in the sense that their surface is ice, frozen there for hundreds, if not billions of years. And we know from past space probes that have flown past and taken pictures of this, and from calculations and from other observations, that this ice is a shell. We don't know how thick this shell is. This is one of the things this mission is going to try and sort out. But underneath that shell, there is water, relatively warm, with nutrients and an energy source. So that's why scientists are excited, because that could be a recipe for life to evolve.
And by life, we're not talking kind of humans and animals, but sort of microbial life. Is that right?
That's right. You'd think of this as like the Earth when it was very, very young. We don't know how life began on the Earth, but one theory is that it began at the ocean floor with these hydrothermal vents where hot water, superheated water, burst through the ocean floor. And it's from the energy and the nutrients and the chemicals and the stability of the environment that some people believe that perhaps the very first primitive organisms, cellular objects, started on planet Earth. Now, scientists point out that if it did that way, and there are lots of other explanations, it's only a suggestion, then those same circumstances could be repeated underneath the oceans of these moons? We don't know. It's a suggestion. This mission is to go there and get some more data.
Now, how are they actually going to get that data from these moons?
Oh, this is so difficult because Jupiter is so far away, 800 million miles. What's going to happen is that for the next 6 years, it's going to go around the sun, and every once in a while it'll encounter Earth or Venus, and it'll get a gravitational kick as it swings around our planet. When it eventually, 2 years after it gets to the Jovian system, goes into orbit of Ganymede, it's got 10 state-of-the-art instruments that are going to take pictures of the icy, pockmarked surface. It's going to pick up the magnetic field of Ganymede. Ganymede is the only moon in the solar system with a magnetic field, and that tells us something about the activity inside the planet. We're going to know Ganymede inside out by the time Juice has been there for a short time.
Now, we're all so excited about this mission to Jupiter, but it's not the only one. There's another one. NASA is sending the Europa Clipper to Jupiter in October of next year. Why the interest in these icy moons right now?
Well, people have been wanting to get there for years. I mean, JUICE is going to look at the three icy worlds, Europa, Callisto, and Ganymede. But the Europa Clipper is going to particularly look at Europa, which is the first world we realized had an under-ice ocean.
Huh.
And it's a remarkable world, which we have more data on than the others. We think its crust is thinner, and it also might even have gaps in the ice where some of the under-ice ocean is being sprayed out in jets. This is remarkable in the sense that you've got two complementary missions which are really going to revolutionize the search for life in space, because there are people who think that it's these icy moons, Europa in particular. Actually, there's more chance of finding life there than there is, say, on the surface of Mars.
David Whitehouse is an astronomer and former BBC science editor. Thanks for taking the time, David.
Thank you.
In the northern Mexican state of Sonora, rock climbing is a relatively new sport. It's largely male-dominated, but a new group is working to make the activity more accessible to women. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk, Kendall Blust has the story.
Paulina Rojas helps Carolina Navarro prepare for her first ever outdoor climb. Surrounded by experienced female climbers, Navarro says she feels safe. And with a final check of her gear, she places chalk-covered hands against the cool rock face and begins her first route. It's scarier than she thought, grasping for finger and footholds as she spiders up the wall.
Tranqui, tranqui, respira.
But when she gets stuck, the group below urges her on.
Bien.
Super bien. With a final push, she reaches the top to the cheers of her fellow climbers. Back on the ground, the slim 30-year-old has ditched her helmet and harness. She says the climb was nerve-wracking, but worth it.
Estoy en una parte de mi vida en la que quiero...
Rock climbing caught her attention, she says, because she's looking for ways to feel stronger and more empowered. That's what this group is all about.
No tiene un nombre como tal. El grupo de WhatsApp se llama Morras Escalando.
For now, simply calling themselves Morras Escalando or Climber Girls, Rojas says the group feels a real need. Rock climbing is just taking off here. And while major Mexican cities like Monterrey, Guadalajara, and Mexico City already have well-established women led climbing communities, that's still not the case in Sonora. Male climbers welcomed Rojas and taught her the sport, she says, but there's still something special about climbing with other women, a different energy and solidarity.
Tenemos los conocimientos, las capacidades, las ganas.
Women have the knowledge, the ability, and the desire to carve out their own space within the Hermosillo climbing community, she says, one where they're neither led nor supervised by men.
Los deportes extremos pueden ser muy intimidantes.
Climbing is an extreme sport, she says. It can be intimidating. So she teamed up with longtime Hermosillo climber Mariana Lopez to create an introductory course for women just starting out. On a chilly Wednesday evening, Rojas and Lopez hook into a makeshift anchor hung on the wall of a small room, giving a demonstration. Over the course of several weeks, they've gone over climbing terminology, gear, and techniques for the dozen or so women in the class.
De hecho, no sabíamos que iba a haber tanta gente en este curso.
Lopez says the course attracted more interest than they expected.
Tener más morras, tener más comunidad.
Climbing with women has a different vibe, she says. they communicate and climb differently than their male counterparts. But that doesn't mean they aren't as good at the sport. Early in her climbing career, she visited Monterrey and saw women there climbing harder routes than the best male climbers she knew in Hermosillo. It showed her what was possible, and she wants newer climbers to see the same potential. On Sunday morning, Rojas welcomes everyone to La Escuelita, part of the El Relis climbing system just south of Hermosillo that's suitable for beginners. They gear up, reviewing how to tie knots and check gear before Lopez begins to climb the granite rock face with yellow wildflowers sprouting out of the craggy surface. Rojas is her belayer, the person who manages the climber's rope.
Clip.
Looking on, Alicia Avila says she joined the course because she's been looking for examples of women climbers. She couldn't find many in the 8 months since she started climbing, but she thinks the new group is a step toward changing that. For Yasmin Duran, it's a way to defy expectations. She says it surprises people when they learn that she's climbing with all women. And the sport has changed her perspective, too. It's a reminder of what she's capable of. Rojas started the group so more women could have that experience.
Es una invitación a las mujeres a que salgamos de nuestra zona de confort.
She calls it an invitation to get out of their comfort zone and try something that might scare them a little, surrounded by women who will be cheering them on. For the World, I'm Kendall Blust in Hermosillo, Mexico.
Today in France, the country's highest court upheld key elements of President Emmanuel Macron's pension reform plan that would raise the retirement age from 62 to 64. This idea is deeply unpopular across France and has led to months of protests. Meanwhile, some people in Paris are cheering the courts for another reason. So-called dark stores, big warehouses used by online delivery services, can now be kicked out of residential neighborhoods. As Rebecca Rossman first reported in the fall, these services may be convenient, but they also come with a cost.
Located in the 11th arrondissement, the Marché d'Aligre is one of the oldest open-air markets in Paris, even predating the French Revolution. Shoppers dragging caddies in the rain stock up on fall vegetables like fresh pumpkin, broccoli, and Brussels sprouts at a very affordable price. So when I start asking people what they think about the new grocery delivery services that have been popping up all over the city, it's no surprise that most people give me a bit of an eye roll.
We live in an area where you can shop every day, so we don't need to order our
groceries.
Yes, so that's why you have this market, plenty of shops, so we don't need.
Need or not, there are now nearly 100 so-called dark stores across Paris today. Recognizable by their blacked out or frosted window fronts, the only people allowed inside the physical shops are the employees. Customers order their groceries online, and then it becomes a race for workers to fill the orders. At this dark store near the Arc de Triomphe in western Paris, run by a startup called Flink, a line of delivery drivers buzz in and out on bikes and scooters to get goods delivered in minutes. Flink's website promises groceries at your door within just 10 minutes. But these shops are creating a backlash so strong that the city is working on a plan to shut them down. It's not just about philosophy.
Moi, je suis pas contre les dark stores. Aujourd'hui, il y a un besoin.
Jeffrey Boulard is the mayor of the 17th arrondissement in western Paris. He says he's not against the dark store concept and adds that the startups have created a lot of jobs.
Parce qu'ils n'arrivent plus à vivre, n'arrivent plus à dormir. Donc ça, c'est totalement inacceptable.
But people can't sleep because of all the noise these stores are making, which he says is totally unacceptable. Deepak, who didn't want to give his last name, runs a flower shop across from a Flink store. He says the shop takes up too much space. Delivery trucks unload at all hours of the day. Delivery drivers are constantly chasing up and down the road. Deepak says it's gotten to the point where he's losing business because people don't want to come down this street anymore.
They are working, they are having a life, it's okay. But it's a way of doing it.
Earlier this week, Emmanuel Grégoire, the deputy mayor of Paris, said the city had begun legal proceedings against 50 dark stores.
four of which are already being fined 200 euros for every day they continue operations. In a statement, Flink told the World that while it didn't want to comment directly about any ongoing legal proceedings, the company remained, quote, dedicated to its mission to simplify the daily lives of the French in order to give them more time for their leisure activities. But it's that philosophical argument that so many people here at the Marché d'Aligre disagree with. Vanessa Mali is shopping for tomatoes with her young daughter. I ask her if she would ever consider ordering groceries online so she could have more leisure time.
I don't think it's a good idea for Europeans. It's better to get outside of your home.
Maybe the dark store concept would work better in a place like America, she says.
But I think for American people it's very good because they don't like to go outside.
For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Paris.
The Library of Congress has a new song in its National Recording Registry. It was composed in Japan in the 1980s, and you probably know it. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
Come right this way and step into my time machine. To 1985.
It's me, Mario!
If you've spent any time around video games, you know this song. The original Super Mario Bros. Theme song. That hummable masterpiece that just won't get out of your head. The brains behind this tune is musician Koji Kondo.
Tring, tring. That's me getting points from coins.
In 1984, Kondo was a senior in college in Osaka, Japan, when he saw a recruiting flyer for a little company called Nintendo on a university bulletin board. He answered the ad, and the rest is history. Here's a rare interview with him from 2009, where he describes his creative process. He says, I wrote the original Mario music by playing an early prototype of the game over and over again. I tried to get a feel for the rhythm and the atmosphere of the game so I could write music that would fit. This was actually something new in the world of video game music. Andrew Sharpman wrote a book about Kondo's score.
Nintendo was the first company to let the sound designer in on the development process. The typical process would be to have a game in the can and give it to someone and say, hey, we need some music to go along with this.
But Kondo was part of the process, not just an afterthought.
The innovation that arises from that is that the audio is much more integrally related to the game itself instead of being sort of wallpaper music, if you will. And Kondo took that idea and really ran with it. And that's one of his major contributions to the history of video game music.
In the 2009 interview, Kondo said he had no idea that the original Super Mario score would take on a life of its own. He says, I'm delighted that so many people are playing it with all kinds of instruments in all kinds of places. Places like the London Philharmonic and The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon. Now, the Mario theme will be preserved in the National Recording Registry of the U.S. Library of Congress. You know what that means. This will still be happening in 200 years. For The World, it's a me, Sarah Birnbaum.
We've run out of quarters for today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Go for your high score this weekend.